So my title is Doubt, the Two-Edged Sword of Spiritual Seekers. And by the way, I was marveling today at Art and Bob, who didn't refer to one note, any scrap of paper. They delivered their whole presentation. But
you can't call us Johnny One Notes.
Right. I, on the other hand, might have my security blanket, because those of you that know me, I'm rather introverted, and being up here is always makes me squirm a bit. But so, yeah, Doubt, the Two-Edged Sword of Spiritual Seekers, is the title of the session. And I'd like to spend some time talking about spiritual teachers and systems and how we can apply doubt in the best way possible to sharpen our inquiry and hasten our way along the path. You know, Richard Rose spent a lot of time, if you read his books, there was a lot of critique about spiritual systems and spiritual teachers. And I actually thought one of the reasons we're here today for Tat is he was so fed up with the charlatans that he ran into that he vowed that if he ever found truth, he would share it freely and commit his life to doing it. And so, you know, even the charlatan teachers have their role for all of us. So first of all, we should all be extremely grateful if we're lucky enough to find an honest teacher. And this is the key to me, the teacher who is also a friend. In my life, I had I'm so grateful that I ran into Richard Rose when I was in my early 20s, and the man essentially following his system blew off my head. That's the result of following his system to the nth degree. And essentially that stripped me of my fear of death, because what I realized following his system, that what we are is eternal. And when everything is stripped away, it's a very, very humbling experience to have what you think is yourself removed and eliminated down to the very ground of your being. But there was more to go. And much later, another teacher, so this is a couple years after the realization in 2007, I ran across another teacher, and that teacher opened my heart to an unimaginable love. And, you know, those that knew me back then, this might be an overstatement, but I felt that I was the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz. I really didn't have a heart. And of course, you know, I did have a heart, but it's relative to what I feel now. It's just a tiny speck. And that, what I realized in a classic bhakti love for the teacher, once that teacher was removed, that I was projecting that love on the teacher, but once the teacher was out of the scene, that love became very impersonal, you know, a capital L love. And then finally, there was another teacher that opened me wide to everything. It actually removed, that teacher removed a lot of the doubt. And so doubt is a big thing for me. That's a big thing for the topic, especially self-doubt. And so it's been a grand journey. That said, I experienced a lot of pitfalls along the way with these teachers. And I'm not critiquing the individual teachers. This is a critique of many of the retreats and many other teachers and talking to many people who have gone to other teachers. You know, so those of you who know me, I'm not critiquing any specific teachers, but this is something I feel is very valuable to share for all of us. You know, Richard Rose, and I believe this was before Tat was formed, one of the things, he had a nucleus of people that wanted to find truth. This would have been in the 60s, I guess. And they had the idea that every person in a group could go to another teacher or another system and explore, and then they would come back to the group and report. So it was a good, efficient way, instead of everybody going to one teacher and learning, you know, one person would go to this teacher, they'd come back to the group and say, this teacher has this or that's crap. And then everybody could get through a bunch of teachers and teachings much more efficiently. So And tat, in a ways, is similar in that there's no discouragement for people to go out and explore and look at other systems and look at other teachers. Find whatever resonates with you, and that's the best approach. So as I said, I encountered a lot of pitfalls with these teachers. And in fact, in the end, what I would say is I failed my way to truth, because everything I tried, pretty much in the end, I exhausted myself looking at everything I could possibly do, throwing all the mud at it that I could. And I know there tends to be, what's interesting to me is there tends to be in spiritual circles, people's willing, their desire is so strong for enlightenment that they're willing to brush off what I see is a lot of bad behavior in teachers. And you know, YouTube is out there, you could see the myriad of what's available. And of course there's a lot of stories from teachers over the years that displayed bad behavior. So one of the things with enlightenment, you know, it's one thing to be enlightened, and it's a whole nother level. It's a whole nother level of responsibility to be a teacher, because a teacher is accountable. They have the psychology of the students in their hands. And so it's not, in my book, permissible to just say, don't expect a certain type of behavior from me if I'm enlightened. If you're a teacher, I darn well expect a certain type of behavior. Not that you know, they should display peaceful and blissful a presentation all the time, but they will have flaws in themselves as well. You know, we're all human. Everybody's human. So I'm not saying that. So I'm going to hit on three key points: doubt, self-delusion, and self-doubt. And discernment is going to be weaved through here. So the first would be doubting teachers and spiritual systems. So, and I mentioned about having a higher standard with that, with a teacher. And one of the things I want to say with this is we've probably all explored teachers, and we've all been burned in some way or another, you know, whether it's financially or just, even if it's nothing very egregious, we've all had a feeling that we've been taken at some point. But we can't blame them. That's the thing. You can't, there's also responsibilities as seekers to not just lay blame and have regrets and try to live in the past. So we as seekers also have a lot of responsibility in the process of studying under a teacher. So here's a couple of areas that I feel are key for evaluating a teacher. And there's many more to consider. In fact, Sean's website, spiritualteachers.org, if you go there and type in guidelines in the search box, it's a really, really good resource, a really good list of criteria, I would say, for looking at teachers and evaluating their authenticity. So the first, you know, this is a kind of a bugaboo, the thing about money. You know, we live in a world of marketing. We're constantly being bombarded by ads, telemarketing, commercials, sales pitches, and it's definitely the same thing in the spiritual circles. So caveat emptor. And I feel, you know, I'll elaborate on this a little bit, but I really feel that money muddies the waters. It really does. And no matter how deeply realized someone is, he or she may start to treat seekers as clients. And therefore, they have the danger of changing their own behavior in their delivery, because, you know, the students and seekers become a source of income. You know, and I'm not saying this, you know, TAT that generally is not, definitely is not financially motivated. I'm not saying this, that TAT is some, you know, some kind of elitist thing that I'm holding out there, that just because money isn't involved in TAT, that TAT is somehow right, or that those that make money are somehow wrong. So, you know, and one example would be those that you see on YouTube or in satsang. They have a certain type of behavior because of the potential revenue in the audience. But then outside, off stage, so to speak, that behavior does not align with what they're saying. So I feel that it's important to see how a teacher interacts with others outside of the retreat setting. And that's what we get here. I mean, you could sit, we're sitting having lunch. We have speakers and teachers, and we're all having lunch together. You really can't tell as we're sitting down at a meal who's the teacher and who's the student. I really always resonated with that in TAT. So I say, get behind the scenes with the teacher and see if he or she walks and talks the same truths. That, to me, was always really important, that those two things are actions and words aligned. The second one would be ritual and hardcore practices. So, you know, light ritual can provide a sense of community. To me, TAT is home. There's a really core bond. I've had friends since the 1980s. Those friendships are for a lifetime. And so community to me is really, really important. But I would be wary of teachers who seem to push their students into certain practices. And this can be a pretty tricky area, because if a teacher doesn't give flexibility for all the myriad ways in which we approach this, you know, and it's really, really become evident to me that the different orientations that we all have, all the wiring that we have is quite different. And I would say there's three main groups. You know, there's those that are very pretty much in their head, those that are very heart-oriented, those that are into their bodies, the kinesthetics and the kundalini. And so it really, really becomes hard for a teacher to try to hit everybody in the audience in a way that can inspire them to keep going and not kind of pigeonhole them into a certain area. So that's where the hardcore practices, in a way, fall short. It's also tricky because if a teacher says too much, we really start to lay our own beliefs and constructs on top of what that teacher is saying. And that's what this is all about. It's undermining the beliefs. The beliefs really become deep-seated. And I have to say, I'm amazed at the beliefs that I had about enlightenment and how deeply, deeply I fooled myself, because it was all about listening to teachers and the way they described their experiences. Or, you know, we could hop from teacher to teacher and we're adding new constructs, trying to get rid of the old ones, and all we're doing is building new constructs on top of, you know, some of the others that we've had. So, and part of the trickiness is if a teacher doesn't say enough, we then start to fill in the information gaps. It's just the natural tendency in the mind. If we don't have the complete picture, then we insert our own beliefs into the gaps that the teacher leaves us. Treatment of others. You know, to me, what's really, really important is the teacher accessible. Is he or she a good friend? You know, and on the flip side of this is, are you seeing unkind behavior from that teacher? And of course, you know, there's notorious stories about physical abuse, sexual abuse. There's some real nasty stuff out there with some of the more notorious teachers. But this can get a bit more subtler. You know, there could be control. There's a control thing with some teachers trying to control their students. Subtle things like ridicule and humiliating others. Or another indicator to me is that teacher trying to divide you from your friends and family, you know, trying to pull you in a bit closer. And this can get, of course, into the real cult stuff. That's some of the darker side of it. And so it's kind of a mystery to me, in a way, that if somebody truly has become their true nature, how they can kind of redescend into the world of illusion, in a way. Because really, this exposure to what we are is should make you quite ordinary. You know, you really see that what you've been looking for has been there the whole time. So it's a much more humbling, in a way, and an ordinary experience. And you realize that what you were looking for, of course, was there all the time. But I think, I guess if I'm trying to speculate at it, that teachers start to feel a sense of specialness again. You know, that's rather than feeling very ordinary in the state of enlightenment, it becomes much more special. And it can really reignite some and magnify some deep-seated conditioning and perhaps lead to all sorts of kind of bad behavior. And I really feel that even a realized teacher has to forever remain vigilant for the ego, you know, for the ego to somehow manifest itself in a dark way. And the last one here is actions and words. Does the teacher say one thing, and I mentioned this already, do they say one thing in front of a spiritual group or on YouTube, but talk or act differently while off stage? Do their actions align with words? So as a tip, as seekers, before we step into a teacher's arena, I really feel it's important to first draw our own line in the sand. For example, we know most of us are unwilling to tolerate physical abuse or sexual abuse, or unwilling to allow someone to rip us off. You know, those are some pretty obvious things. But yet, time and again, people get wrapped up into these teachings. And then I've heard people justify the behavior of the teacher by saying it really doesn't matter. They're doing their behavior for a certain reason. And as long as they're going to take me down the road of enlightenment, that kind of behavior is fine. I can dismiss it. And I just, you think after the teacher bought the 96 Rolls Royce, you know, it's time to head for the exit door. But how many people continue to stick around? You know, or if the guru slept with your wife. I've heard stories about these and where people tolerated it. And as another tip, I would say we should set our boundaries in advance and then watch the rationalizations, watch our mind rationalize and dismiss the odd behaviors in a teacher. And I'm not talking about running the other way when we see small displays of quirkiness. Again, as I said, teachers are humans, and so they are going to be quirky in their own way. But we should take note, and if that evidence becomes strong enough or sufficient, then it's just time to move on. And that's really a difficult place to be when you're with a teacher, knowing when all the gifts have been given, and when it's time to move on. It's like any other relationship. You know, you have to have discernment that perhaps for some teachers, everything's been exhausted, everything that you can get from that teacher. And if you stick around and you get the messages of resistance, you know, you could, I think it was mentioned today, you could spend 10 years, you know, squandering your search and your energy under a teacher who may have only had a little piece of your path. So those are some perspectives on applying doubt to teachers and spiritual systems. The second thing I mentioned was self-delusion. And this is an incredibly tenacious and pervasive quality of the mind. And those of you that have watched your mind long enough, you see that one part of you fools another part. It's basically one voice tends to be louder than all the other voices, and that's the one that wins out. So there's like an argument, an inner argument going on. And we as spiritual seekers often feel we're a bit smarter by thinking that we've given up all the material pursuits, you know, and now we're pursuing something that's more worthy or more meaningful in life. But things get tricky because there's still a deep conviction, a deep self-delusion that enlightenment is somehow going to add something to our life. Or it's going to remove all the stuff we don't like about ourselves, but somehow leave behind everything that we still enjoy. Or we might have deep discoveries by seeing that we're separate from our thoughts. You know, and this is a fairly substantial leap when we take a step inward and we see that we're separate from our thoughts and feelings, but then delude ourselves by building even a new identity around the witness or the observer. So self-delusion ultimately ends when we disidentify with everything. And one strategy to help us see through self-delusion is to doubt everything. In Psychology Observer, Rose said, "We must learn to doubt not only the verbal testimonies of others, but the persuasions of our own beliefs, and keep looking for symptoms of self-delusion." He also said, "You should believe nothing, including what I say. You should doubt. To doubt is sacred. To believe is foolishness, because believing is an easy way out. It's a cop-out." And of course, I have to flip because the spiritual search is full of paradoxes. And so, you know, I was thinking about that, and just to illustrate that no single rule applies to everyone, in I Am That, you know, that's a question and answer format. Somebody asked Nisargadatta how he came to his realization, and he said, "By my trust in my guru. He told me, 'You alone are,' and I did not doubt him. I was merely puzzling over it until I realized that it is absolutely true." You know, so here again, the paradox permeates all spiritual teachings. So no rule applies to everything, but I definitely would say I would hinge my hat on the doubt. And so going back to the doubt, you know, it's probably best if others doubt me as well. You know, I'm not a guy that has a lot of fireworks, so the doubt is going to come easy. I don't have, I tend to, when I'm up here talking, sometimes I see glazed eyes and I'm thinking, geez, I'm putting them to sleep more than I am keeping them awake. We're trying to wake them up. So by my very ordinariness, I think that leads to doubt, and it's a healthy thing. It's a healthy thing for everybody to doubt what they're hearing. You know, I know this sounds trite, and it's something that's repeated a lot in spiritual circles, but I don't have anything that everybody here doesn't already have. You know, it's an intrinsic aliveness, beingness. There's nothing absolutely different about me from what I would say my old seeker Phil, except it's an experiential recognition of my true nature. And you know, that would be what I would say is the only difference I could see. If you have somebody who's a dynamic speaker and full of the fireworks, that's much more captivating. And again, I think it's really important to be on guard and not just believe because of the dynamic delivery of the speaker. You know, and the other thing I'd like to do, I just love the search for truth. To me, it's just been a passion since I've been in my late teens. And if I feel like there's anything I can do, it's to light that fire in you. That's about the best I can do. I can't give, nor can any teacher give you prescriptive advice. But the best things that the teacher did for me is they inspired me to the next step. And they gave me the freedom to look and continue to apply myself in a way that I felt was best. So, you know, I would just want my love of truth to catch fire in you as well. What else can we do about self-delusion as it applies to spiritual seekers and systems? For one, you know, we could take responsibility for our own decisions. All of us, as I said, have been fooled at some point on the path by someone. But we got a hell of a lot smarter after being fooled. We got much wiser. And I think what's important is to go back and you know, step back and figure out why we as seekers disregard the wisdom that's being conveyed to us, and rationalize. You know, we ignored the intuitive voices instead of acting more wisely at the time. So as a tip, I would say such intuitions usually don't come with strong rationale. You know, decisions from the ego have a long laundry list of why I should or shouldn't be doing something, where I've often found my intuition just didn't really have a good reason. So I was getting a message, I was hearing the wisdom, but ignoring it. Spiritual seekers are always a guessing about, you know, I played the game, and I probably still play the game to some extent. We're trying to figure out which teacher is truly realized. And again, as I say, we all have what we're looking for. We're just not recognizing that. So as another tip, I say make the trip ourselves instead of leaning too heavily on a teacher. I have to say, I'm pretty much, it's a universal thing. Those around Richard Rose leaned on him so heavily. I think it was mentioned today about waiting for him to, he talked about transmission, waiting for him to zap. And I realized I leaned so heavily on the teacher that I got lazy myself, really, really lazy. And so be aware that a teacher is going to express his or her understanding of truth is going to be quite different than the next teacher over. So what I mean by that is the teacher's personality, the degree of suffering going into it, their genetic makeup, nervous systems, family upbringing, you know, that all affects how a teacher discovers and expresses the truth. So live your own truth. That's the big part of the message. Live your own truth. And I feel that also applies. Rose talked about the law of the ladder. And the law of the ladder was to, which I find fairly unique in TAT, was to work with others on one rung below you, or work on those on the rung with you. And in turn, you should be working with a person above you on the ladder in the frame of friendship. And those people that you work with below you push you up in a way. And so when you, I say live your own truth, but not only that, teach from your own level of truth. We all have something that we know based on the introspection that we've done over the years. We have something we can give to others. And I have to say, always what I give has been given back in spades. And so that is a huge, huge thing. And I don't do it because I expect something in return. It's just done, again, because of the love of truth. So to steal and rephrase someone else's quote, the spiritual path to me is all about the journey, not about getting to the destination. You know, we could stop, as Bob mentioned this morning, we could stop looking for the grand mal enlightenment somewhere over the horizon and begin recognizing the magic of what's unfolding now. So my third point is, and last point, is self-doubt and cynicism. This is a big, big thing for me, the self-doubt. Rose said, you have to doubt everything but your own ability. If you doubt your ability, you won't try. And we have to have faith in ourselves. You know, we're given one card, so to speak. You get a free pass on beliefs. And that one belief is to believe in yourself, not to believe somebody else's truth or believe in a system, but believe in yourself. Have faith in yourself. Trust in it. Trust in life. And I remember people talking about that, and I couldn't get what were they saying. Well, how could I just step into air and expect there to be a stepping stone there for me? And when you really listen to the wisdom of yourself, what and follow your heart, you can trust in it. And I know a lot of people will go down this path. There was some discussion today at breakfast where you get in an energized environment, you come to a TAT weekend, and you start to see what I would call the grosser aspects of yourself. And you think, my God, I'm going backwards. You know, I'm seeing the stuff in myself because it's stirred up. and I'm just not getting it. I'm going in the wrong direction. And what I really feel is the more conscious you get, the more coarse stuff tends to become evident. And that's what's happening. It's not that you're going astray. You're actually seeing parts about yourself that were hidden. Cynicism, you know, is another, you wouldn't be here if you were cynics, I don't think. You know, and I would define cynicism as a form of giving up. We can actually misuse this doubt to the point where we doubt everything, and that includes all spiritual endeavors, all spiritual teachers, and just simply give up, say that we're wasting our time. But I really think, and I think you all know, that that would be an insidious form of rationalization to not seek. And I really feel that it's extraordinarily difficult to do this alone. Really, really difficult. And so we must take action, inquire and investigate, find out for ourselves, so that your experience becomes firsthand and authentic. That's the thing, not somebody else's truth. So in my case, you know, when my head opened up to the ground of my being, I still had doubts. And I wrote about that. I was very open to what happened almost immediately after, which was the mind. It's almost like nature suffers no vacuum. The mind came in. The mind is a doubt machine. So when everything was cleared out and I truly saw what I am, I wrote about the doubts and the self-doubts and was stuck there for years because I couldn't accept the simplicity of like trying to ram the gate, to try to beat the gate down, and then realize that, my God, I've been standing, I am what I've been looking for. I've been standing in the garden the whole time. So the simplicity of that would not be accepted. And that's where the self-doubt came in. So like this is a two-edged sword in a way. That self-doubt, if I had accepted, it really wasn't my choice, but if I had just accepted it and stopped there, I would never have experienced the depth of love that came later. And so that self-doubt in a way kept me going, you know, kept me open to more possibilities. What I think became evident to me was I knew the self-doubt was there. I wrote about it. I acknowledged it, but I hadn't figured how deeply gripped in its grip I was. I had no idea. And as I said, it was like, it was like a lover by my side. More or less, you know, I describe it as being a spoiled, rotten teenager who had been given the greatest gift. And so I had to leave home and go out and look for more. And I was given great gifts in spades. As I said, the love to me was a great gift in spades. But when the self-doubt crumbled finally, I realized that I had done a full circle and actually just came back home. And so I came, in a way, you know, I went a roundabout way of coming right back to the realization I had in 2007 that what I had been looking for, I was, and it was always there. And it is always there in every person. But, you know, this time, what I would say is the whole thing equalized. And I get what Bob was saying before. It's really hard not to talk about it from a certain standpoint, but I can't help myself. So, you know, what I would say is it's like a grand flip. So what consciousness is so buried deep, but that we cannot live without it. So it's what breathes life into us. It is so buried deep beneath the noise of the mind that we just can't see it. And I say the best we can do is what I would say is an umbilical cord, and that umbilical cord back to our source, is the constant looking, the constant looking of the mind, looking at the mind from something more intrinsic, more alive, awareness, you know, consciousness, beingness, whatever you want to call that. And then at some point, it really feels to me like what was so small and particularized and individualized and buried so deep within the mind's noise and the distraction of self being pulled outward, that being flipped now, that the mind now takes a back seat. And, you know, I talked about my trip in some other talks. You know, what I see is, first went the fear of death. So that's what I mean by opening up my head, where I realized the ground of my being, and that it was eternal, unchanging. And the love to me, the other way I would pitch that is I finally opened myself to love because I feared it. And what fell away was the fear of love. And, you know, with the self-doubt, there was a fear of what I would call fear of self. I might call it aversion of self, small s self. I couldn't accept the humanness side of the equation. I couldn't accept that self was just doing its thing and it's naturally geared. Evolution gears to look outward and protect us. And all it's doing is what it does best, which is try to survive. And so even in the light of seeing what I did and feeling love, when that fell away, when I accepted, when I, instead of pushing self away, pulling it in closer and saying, this is part of me. You know, there's two sides of the equation here. And the only difference I could say is it's now viewed from a solid rock, that it's a solid ground of being. So the self flows just like everything else in life. Things come and go, and it's okay to be there. And I would say it's a peaceful coexistence, you know. And this, there's a really, really profound and deep appreciation for what we are. We are truly a transformer between heaven and earth. That's what we are. And if you look at it, we're a miracle. We're taking this being, this nervous system is transforming this empty, spacious, unchanging oneness into everythingness. And that's kind of a, well, it's not kind of, it's an amazing thing that's really taken for granted. And it's really, really, I feel very grateful for some of the discoveries all along the path here. And that, you know, that's a transformer of love. That's what it is. So, in closing, I just want to say that the greatest antidotes to self-delusion and self-doubt are self-honesty, sincerity, perseverance. And these, if there's anything to take away, those three things These are the three qualities in the secret that really allow us to pierce the veil, and so that we may discover our full potential. So thank you all for your time and attention. How is our time, Cole?
It's another 15 minutes of this first session to get up.
Okay. I guess if there's any questions, have some time for it. Yeah. Talking, I think the first thing that came to mind was I feel like Rose used to talk about Kivala Nirvikalpa Samadhi, which was, I think this is from Ramana Maharshi. Yeah, and then there was a Kivala, and yeah. That used to. Yeah. And so what I would say, Mike, is to me the first experience was I would say like a bucket being lowered into a well. That's the way he described it. And so, I was lowered into the well of my being, and everything was stripped away. But the bucket came back up, and this. I hesitate to talk about my story because then it generates more beliefs. But so this might be really unique to me. But as I said, the reason the bucket came back up, I don't really know in answer to your question. But what I did see is I could not accept the simplicity of the answer. So I only feel like there was some greater intelligence that said, you're half-baked, Phil. There's more to go. And like I said, then the next thing, fear is a big thing. It keeps the impersonal love at bay constantly. And so there had to be another lesson there, and that lesson was the fear of love. And until my heart opened to that love. And I'm not talking about a Pollyannic love of a great place in the world. I'm talking about a very intrinsic, deep, deep feeling of love. And then the only thing that I was grappling with was the fact that, and this goes back to beliefs being so strong, that I had heard so many times over and over from different teachers about small as self or self being, this being an experience of no self. And so, we build these things up in our head, these beliefs about somehow the slate's going to be wiped clean. Or, as I said, like all the good stuff remains and the bad stuff goes, but self includes everything. And so, there was something I wanted to say and lost my train of thought. I just feel like when there's an experience of everythingness, so there's an experience of nothingness, that's what happened to me in 2007. The experience of everythingness includes small s self, it includes the world, it includes a recognition of what you are and what you aren't at the same time. So self has its role. It's a dual recognition. And self, I know what I was going to say. To me, this description of no self, it means it's not a solid self. It's not the self that we think we are. So the solid sense of self, when people are talking, teachers were talking about being everything, I see that self flows just like everything else in life. So it's motion. You know, meaning our feelings, our thoughts, things are rising and falling just like everything else in life. So it's coming and going. So it doesn't exist in the way we think it does. It's just a very fluid aspect. And so, you know, I really feel like the final lesson was, or where it's headed now, is like the fear of life. You know, the fear of expressing this in whatever way I can best express it. You know, I probably shine most in, you know, one-on-one discussion over lunch, as opposed to trying to express this up here. So, you know, that might be kind of a way of describing the fear of life, you know, just being able to go through life and express myself in the best way possible. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. You got more than you bargained for.
Phil, any more you can say or care to say about how the loss of, what was the burden, the self-doubt, how that unfolded?
Yeah. So I was at a retreat. I won't mention the teacher because I don't want people running after the teachers thinking that teacher's going to do something special for them. But what occurred to me in this retreat, I was having so much fun in the retreat itself. And I've told the story, like the humor and whatnot reminded me of Richard Rose. Richard Rose was great at just making people laugh. He was, I'd often be at TAP meetings with tears coming out and my belly hurting, I was laughing so hard. So part of what I recognized in this retreat, I was just so relaxed back into myself, and I watched the beliefs about what enlightenment was as this teacher expressed and sat saying, and I'm sitting with myself in silence. One by one, the constructs of, you know, one being the grand mal enlightenment, but all these other deep-seated beliefs about what enlightenment were it was like this, I think Bart talks about the scaffolding. You know, like the scaffolding was on props, and my mind was on props. So one at a time, the scaffolding just started to shake. And what I feel was the very last beam holding it up, so to speak, was self-doubt. And it actually took a few months after that to begin where the what I would call the flipping occurred, where my consciousness, awareness, beingness became more abiding, more present, more, you know, if you want to say, just much more in my face. And so the self-doubt was the fact that what I said before, like I had realized I had been home this whole time. And I couldn't accept the implications of what I saw in 2007, that it was that simple. So I, you know, I was so doubting of that experience and the depth of that, that I had to somehow just go through another, I can't explain that part of the trip. But as I said, all the gifts have been amazing in the interim. So, there's still there's still old thought patterns that come up. The difference is I see the self-doubt now playing its game. And like I said before, it's like now viewed from the solid rock of consciousness. And it can't deceive me anymore. It can't fool me. Like many, many different things, but self-doubt being one. So if I could describe it that way, you know, it's like not like everything gets wiped away all at once, but there's a comfort with self doing its thing, including self-doubt. You know, the self wants to survive, so that's always what it's trying to do. and one of which is self-doubt. You know, self-doubt keeps it going, keeps the mind's noise generating itself. So I don't know if that's really clear. That's about kind of the best way I could express that. David?
Yeah, you've kind of already said it, but let me get your reaction to the way that some mainstream teachers approach this business about misbehavior. You know, I think those of us who've been around, even most renowned teachers, some of them engage in significantly bad misbehavior, even the most renowned ones. And then there's the rationalization, well, that's just, they're beyond social convention, and two, that's what that particular seeker needs.
I heard Richard Rose one time say, even the greatest charlatan might save somebody from suicide. They all have their role. And, you know, my experience, a teacher appeared and gave what I needed exactly at that time. And so, it's kind of hard to explain. It's a really, really mystical thing to me, and I don't know. But you're right, each teacher is married to each seeker for a certain reason. Sitting in front of everybody and talking.
is there an outcome that concerns you, or a possible outcome, or is it just introverted, social anxiety?
No, I was sort of joking. I would say it's accepting more. It's a greater acceptance of the unknown. I mean, okay. There's just no way I could know what's going to happen when I'm stepping out, of the room here, let alone what's going to happen a month from now. So we're all really afraid of the unknown, and there's a much more comfort. I could see that now as much, much more comfort. You know, those of you, I think we just have another minute or two, but those of you that know me well, I've retired in February. And I could have never have done that again by like stepping out into air without totally trusting and just some other life lessons leading up to that. And so that's stepping into the unknown, and it's been, I don't want to rub it in too much, but it's a fantastic thing. It's been amazing what's happened since then. I actually kind of feel it's all tied together with this settling into this. It's given me the space to do that instead of, pulling me out and wasting all my time engaged in a job. I think one last question from Krista.
Hey, I just wanted to make an announcement. I don't know how many of you ever worked with Jim Burns or knew him well. He has about 3 weeks to live. His mind is very sharp. But his body is dwindling quickly.
Oh.
You know, he's maybe 120 pounds, and y'all know he was close to 300. So he's 85, and he's in Pittsburgh. If anyone, wanted to see him, they probably have about 2 or 3 more weeks left to do that.
Chris, have you by chance contacted Bart Marshall for that information?
No, but I will. Maybe.
Will you?
Yes.
I will.
Okay, yes. I don't know.
Because you contacted him. I don't have his information. I have
contact him.
I just saw he's not, he's not in North Carolina. He's up in North Dakota or something.
Maybe.
Yes.
If Sean has his contact information.
So
yeah, thanks for doing that, Krista.
Wanted to go see him. His mind is just as bright as it can be. But his wrists are smaller than mine.
Oh wow. Okay, again, thank you. And then we have a report. Is it rapport sitting next, right? So I would ask if those of you that want to sit together in silence, I'll have a little bit of a lead-in with it, and we'll do it here. So I would say let's get the chairs in like a circle here. And then we'll just do that as a last thing for the night.
15 minutes.
Yeah, why don't we give like a 10-minute break? Come back in about 10 minutes. Yeah, thanks for letting me know.